Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Protests, anger, and frustration on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. A grand jury decides not to indict Darren Wilson, the white police officer who shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown. No probable cause for any of the five possible charges. This hour on Point, a grand jury's decision and fire on the streets of Ferguson. You can join us on air or online. Did the grand jury get it right or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With me first from St. Louis, Missouri, is Susan McGraw, professor at St. Louis University Law School and practicing defense attorney. Susan McGraw, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
So you were there when the decision came down. Describe that moment last night.
Well, you know, it was interesting because I was with some media people, but I was with a couple of prosecuting attorneys and a civil rights lawyer. And I think that a lot of us expected that was going to happen just from the way that we had seen the grand jury going. Obviously, the reaction of people from Ferguson was much, much different and more volatile than ours.
Here's some sound last night. St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar saying that the protests after the decision came down quickly turned violent.
I really don't have any hesitation in telling you that I didn't see a lot of peaceful protest out there tonight, and I'm disappointed about that. I'm not saying there weren't folks out there that were out there for the right reason. I'm not saying that wasn't the case, but I am saying that, unfortunately, this spun out of control.
And in an interview with CNN after the grand jury decision was announced, one angry protester questioned the lack of an indictment.
What are you saying? That our lives are not equal? Our lives are not worthy of not even a day in court? That's what you just said.
Susan McGraw, after a night of looting and some real disappointment and anger last night, what's the sense on the ground there today?
I think that everybody's very guarded about what might happen today, or especially what might happen tonight. I am downtown across from the courthouse at our law school. There are National Guard stationed along the street in front of both courthouses and in front of our jail. I think people are very concerned about a repeat of last night.
Let me bring in another voice now from Ferguson, Missouri, Jelani Cobb, contributor to The New Yorker, where he has written eloquently about the chasm between the police and the community in Ferguson. He's an associate professor of history and director of Africana Studies at the University of Connecticut. Jelani Cobb, welcome back to On Point. So nice to have you.
Thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. How are you? What happened last night? What did you see after the decision came down in Ferguson?
So I was out near the police station, which is kind of central, the downtown district of Ferguson. And, you know, when the decision was, released, you saw people milling about. The initial response that, you know, as I would gauge it, was kind of somber. And, you know, people were, you know, disappointed. There were some statements about the lack of justice and, you know, some anger as well. But it took about maybe 15 minutes before the tensions really began to ratchet up. And, you know, the way the street is structured is kind of a narrow corridor. So police had blocked off the south end of the street. And then shortly after, I guess maybe 15 or 20 minutes after the announcement, you heard a few gunshots on the north side of the street. And then you saw kind of a cordon action with the police where they came down from the north side as well. So it kind of created a bottleneck, you know, where protesters were between the police and the police on the north and south sides of the street, and then the police department itself, you know, being on, I think, the east side of the street. And so that was the dynamic that was there. And, you know, there was some violence. There were, you know, a couple of police cars that were set on fire and so on. But the skirmishes on South Florissant Street in the district, business district area were not really very long-lived.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of town, near Canfield Drive, where Michael Brown was killed, there was a remarkably, notably smaller police presence. And that was why I think the epicenter for the destruction has been there, in that location. And you know, earlier in the evening, I posed the question to Governor Nixon about whether they would, use police armored vehicles and tear gas, and he refused to respond. But what I did see was that they used tear gas and they used armored vehicles very quickly on the in the business district, mm-hmm. and almost no presence on the black side of town.
Interesting. Well, last night, St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Robert McCullough made this statement about the grand jury and its decision, making a decision based on the evidence solely.
Physical evidence does not change because of public pressure or personal agenda. Physical evidence does not look away as events unfold, nor does it block out or add to memory. Physical evidence remains constant.
Susan McGraw, the prosecutor there, promised last night, actually, that he would allay any suspicions about the fairness of the proceedings by releasing transcripts of the testimony that the grand jury saw and other evidence heard by the panel. How unusual is that?
Oh, it's very unusual. It's very unusual. It's unusual for a grand jury not to indict a person who is brought before them. So that's the first thing that was unusual. To keep a record of what happens at grand jury is very unusual. Usually the prosecuting attorney will not keep a record of witnesses' testimony for fear that it might be used later at trial to impeach or contradict a witness. So that's unusual. And then again, the release of all the testimony after someone's not indicted is very unusual. There have been complaints all along that the prosecuting attorney has chosen a grand jury procedure which is not normally used, which is not used for the typical civilian defendant. And it's caused a lot of bad feelings here in St. Louis by the public who have not seen other people treated this way.
The prosecutor said that several key eyewitness accounts of the shooting had changed over time or were, quote unquote, inconsistent with the physical evidence, including those who said that Michael Brown was trying to surrender that night when he was shot. Given that this these transcripts and this evidence has been released, walk us through a couple of the key pieces here, anything that surprised you, Susan.
You know, what surprised me, I guess, first of all, was the way that Officer Wilson's testimony was handled during the grand jury proceeding. You know, in the United States, we have made a conscious decision that the weight of the truth is to have opposite sides of people, parties on the law, fight it out, right? And the truth comes from the evidence being tested by two separate parties. Well, we didn't see that here, and I think people need to understand that there was no cross-examination involved of Officer Wilson's testimony, that it was presented by the prosecuting attorney. Much of how it was presented was through leading questions or questions where you suggest the answer to the question in your question. So that is not really the what we would expect in a trial setting in terms of testing a witness's statement or account of the facts.
Jelani Cobb, how did you see the testimony in some of these transcripts that were released yesterday?
So I haven't had a chance to review the entire transcript, but one thing that didn't strike me from Prosecutor McCullough's commentary yesterday was that he sounded very much like a defense attorney. And if, in fact, the statements that he made about evidence being contradictory and so on, it seemed like if he was indeed a prosecutor, those would be things that he would take into consideration in the way in which he presented this information to the grand jury. But listening to it almost from the beginning, you could tell that this was a preface to him saying that there had been no indictment. And it raised serious questions. And there have been doubts all along. If you talk to certainly if you talk to African-American residents in this area, there have been doubts all along about Prosecutor McCulloch's willingness and commitment to actually bringing an indictment, actually winning an indictment against Mr. Wilson in the first place. And there was nothing he said last night that contradicted that impression.
Would you agree with that, Susan McGraw?
I agree 100%. I mean, I am a defense attorney, and it sounded very much like what the type of things that I would have said about my client. So I'm in complete agreement with that.
I was interested to hear that this grand jury was convened back in May, almost 3 months before the shooting of Michael Brown. How did that impact reaction to the decision, Susan McGraw?
Well, how did it impact reaction to the decision? I think that it was just one more abnormality that people were concerned about. I'll tell you why it's a little bit troublesome. Is beginning in May, the regular grand jury proceeding had been followed, where the state would come in, they would give a case, they would make a case towards indicting a person. It would be a brief, you know, 1 hour to 3 hours at the most kind of hearing, mm-hmm. and then they'd move on. Well, beginning in August, they began to see that this case was going to be treated differently, that the regular procedure was not going to be followed. And there's a question as to whether that was appropriate, whether there was consciously or unconsciously a message sent to the grand jury that this case was to be treated differently than the regular grand jury case.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the grand jury decision in Ferguson, Missouri. Violent protests last night. Protesters attempted to tip over a police car, threw rocks at police officers. You can join the conversation. What are the lessons of Ferguson? Last night, after the grand jury decision was announced, President Obama said there are lessons to learn from the tragic events in Ferguson.
We need to recognize that this is not just an issue for Ferguson. This is an issue for America. We have made enormous progress in race relations over the course of the past several decades. I have witnessed that in my own life, and to deny that progress, I think, is to deny America's capacity for change.
Jelani Cobb joins us this hour from Ferguson, contributor to The New Yorker and director of Africana Studies at the University of Connecticut. And with us from St. Louis, Susan McGraw, a professor at St. Louis University Law School and a practicing defense attorney. I want to bring another voice now, a Ferguson community member. Patricia Bynes joins us from Ferguson. She's the Democratic committeewoman for Ferguson Township. Patricia Bynes, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
It's nice to have you. After last night, what are your feelings about the grand jury decision?
I think it was more like a information dump on some citizens. I don't know how many of them are actually attorneys, you know, but to give them all of this information with no guidance, I don't think that this was the right process.
What should the process have been?
Well, I think Bob McCulloch should have done what prosecutors do, but I think it became very clear that he did not want to charge Officer Wilson in this case. So it kind of just gave citizens, a jury, lots of information, not a lot of guidance, and kind of left it up to them to absolve himself.
Here is the prosecuting attorney, Robert McCullough, saying that the protests have started an important conversation.
It's opened old wounds, and it's given us an opportunity now to address those wounds, as opposed to in the past where they just fade away. For how many years have we been talking about the issues that lead to incidents like this, and yet after a period of time, it just sort of fades away. I urge everybody who's engaged in the conversation, who's engaged in the demonstrations, to keep that going, to stay with that, not to let that go.
The St. Louis County prosecutor there, Robert McCullough, said that the protests spawned by the shooting and the grand jury decision have started an important conversation in Ferguson. Do you hear that conversation in the community, on the streets, Patricia Bynes?
Well, these conversations haven't started with this. My community has been talking about these issues well before I was even born. They're the same issues that we do not tackle and deal with. So this is not the start of a conversation. I think what has started is some people have actually started listening. That's what started.
So what now today in Ferguson? You're a township Democratic Committee, a township leader. What do you hope Ferguson gets out of this, moves forward from this? What do you want to have happen in Ferguson now?
Well, this isn't just Ferguson. Here in St. Louis, all of these municipalities, they're really just neighborhoods with their own government. And we live within a region, but we also live within a country where these are the same issues throughout our country. So whatever questions that this is creating for people in their community, I need them to go ask those questions where they live. I need them to question their mayor. I need them to question their chief of police. I need them to question their alderman or their council people, and ask about militarization, ask about policing policies, ask about police accountability. That's what I need everybody across this country to do.
Patricia Bynes, the Democratic Committee Woman for Ferguson Township. Thanks for being with us today, Patricia. All the best.
Thank you.
Let's get some calls in here from Nashville, Tennessee. First, Carl is on the line. Hi, Carl. Welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Well,
first of all, as a black person in America, I was not surprised by the Nunn indictment. Not at all. Unfortunately, we have two sets of laws in this country, one for white Americans and one for others, black, Hispanic. It doesn't matter. That's something that just stands out in history, recent history. But what does surprise me is how the prosecutor, in this case, was so much like a defense attorney doing an indictment with the grand jury. I've never seen this happen. Normally, within 99% of the prosecutors around this country, they are on the side of the victim and not on the side of the person accused of the crime during the indictment phase of a case. And I've never, ever seen, and no one can, how can this be explained away to anyone? And even to a person like me, who is as cynical the justice system in America as I am, was still taken aback. And if I'm taken aback at the action of the prosecution, in this particular crime, I know the rest of America is taken aback as much as I am.
Great, Carl. Thank you. Thank you very much from Nashville there. Here's Robert in Florence, South Carolina. Robert, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Go ahead.
I'm in law enforcement, and I've been watching this from day one. I believe that Michael Brown triggered the events that led to his death. I'm not saying that towards the end of the encounter, the officer could have acted different, but we know from watching the video of him robbing the store that he obviously was not a law-abiding citizen. When he was engaged by the police, he challenged the authority. He reached in through the police, through the cruiser, to try and disarm the officer. When you try to disarm a law enforcement officer, the use of deadly force is warranted.
You're a law enforcement, Robert, and I respect, you know, what you do. Can you talk a little bit about the distrust, though, of people specifically in communities of color toward police officers and law enforcement generally?
Well, I really don't want to get too deep into it, but attitude makes the encounter. That's it. Attitude makes the encounter. He was walking down the middle of a road where a car was supposed to be, not a pedestrian. It's normal for someone, a law enforcement officer, to engage a civilian walking down the middle of the road. Are they drunk? Are they hurt? Are they disoriented? And I think, and I wasn't there, and it's hard for me to make the call, but I think from that point, when Michael Bryant was engaged by the officer, he had an attitude problem. And again, I'm not saying that the officer could have ended the exchange different, but when he reached in through that car window, he set himself up for deadly force.
All right, Robert. Thank you. Thank you very much. Jelani Cobb, let me bring you in here. I'm looking at a tweet here from Wesley Lowry, who's a reporter at The Washington Post. He says, quote, I think America must see the riots and what's going on in Ferguson, that they do not develop out of thin air. A riot is the language of the unheard, quoting Martin Luther King Jr. Talk a little bit about the distrust that I just brought up with Robert there in law enforcement, of course, but specifically in Ferguson and the distrust of police by that community specifically.
So I think, you know, it's exhausting to hear comments like the previous caller, because in law enforcement, you know, I suppose it's like a presumption of credibility. And unless you're someone who experiences, you know, my first interaction with law enforcement was when I was 13 years old and I was coming home from a Little League game and a police officer threw me against a mailbox and frisked me. I was wearing a Little League uniform because he said that I was possibly a gang member who matched a description that had been for a crime that had been committed. And, you know, if you have not had those experiences, presumably you could think the way Robert thinks, that he believes the story that Mr. Brown reached into the car. And he believes the story that this person precipitated his own death. But in what country do we believe that it is reasonable to shoot a person six times when you have a weapon and they have no weapon and they end up dead on the pavement? They're left on the pavement for 4.5 hours. And believe that the community is actually supposed to respect, you know, this the judicial process that these officers represent.
Let me get a couple of listeners in here on Facebook. Kel says, how could a trained police officer with plenty of weapons be in fear for his life from an unarmed teenager? Jason responds, justice was served. Move on to teach your children to not rob stores, not fight police, and listen to police. Gene from Twitter says, how are any of us in a better position to judge than a grand jury? Let me bring in another voice now from Ferguson, Reverend Willis Johnson. He's the pastor of the Wellspring Church in Ferguson. Reverend Johnson, nice to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jay.
What's your sense of the feelings in Ferguson after the decision last night?
Well, we're very saddened. It's quite disheartening. The events that have transpired not just yesterday evening, but for well over 107 days now in this community, across this community, from its leadership at its highest levels, the judicial system, all the way down to the municipalities and even into our own homes and kitchen tables. All of us in this community are challenged by this. And have to remain answerable and accountable at the same time.
Reverend, what are you going to say to your congregation on Sunday?
Well, first, I'm not going to wait till Sunday. I've been on the phone throughout much of the morning, yesterday evening, and even at my own living room with my own family, having to help to bring some sense of security and assurance that that through all this, there's going to be something transformative, something better than what we are and have experienced to this date. I'm reminding folks that we cannot give up, nor should this be the time that we back down. And that may sound very strong, and that may be interpreted differently depending on the ears and the hearts in which it reaches. But I do share the idea that while there are those who protest, another form of protest or shared experience of the unheard and the unexamined is prayer. And I'm not Pollyanna with my reference to saying about prayer, but obviously there has to be a greater power within us and beyond us to get us through and to where we're supposed to be in this community, because right now the methodology and the practices, the systems and the people that we've entrusted this to happen or help us lead us to that place are not doing so.
Well, let me follow on that. The St. Louis County Executive, Charlie Dooley, asked the St. Louis region to, quote, begin the hard process of healing. Based on what I just heard you say, you know, how does that happen? Is that possible?
Well, definitely it's possible. I think, you know, you're not going to get a consensus on, first of all, what justice is or what and how long and in what way we begin to heal and be really rehabilitated. I've always looked at this as a traumatic experience. I've always looked at this community since August 9th as a community in trauma. And anyone in the medical profession knows that the first thing you have to do is at least try to stabilize the patient. We have done little to none of that with this process and with a lot of our actions, again, across the board, across the spectrum of this community, not just locally, but state and, mm-hmm, and nationally. Mm-hmm. And we don't have time to be pointing fingers. We're all accountable. I don't just pastor in Ferguson. I live in Ferguson. I understand what some of the comments I've heard. There's a responsibility as a parent. There's a responsibility as a cleric, as a leader, political leader, civic leader, all that. All of us have, there's enough responsibility going around.
Yeah.
At some point, we've got to be willing to actually remain answerable to questions. Because we don't, as much as we listen, think we listen, we're not listening with empathy, with understanding that is deeper than just trying to get out of the room and get out of the situation or check a box.
Reverend Willis Johnson, I appreciate so much your thoughts and your time. We need to move on. There's so much to cover here. But thank you very, very much, sir, for being with us. Good luck.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. More comments from our Facebook page. Here's Marty that says, thug robs and then attacks responding cop inside the car, outside the car. It doesn't matter the color of his skin. He was a violent criminal, and he's dead because of himself, not the cop. In response, John says, white is right. Black lives do not count. Back to the phones now. Keenan from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Keenan. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. As a black male, but I'm also an educator, so I see what's going on out here. There is such a lack of leadership in our community that our men don't know who our enemies are. We have black people killing black people. We have cops killing black people. So the people that you're supposed to be protected by, which are people that in your community or police officers, are the people that are killing you. And It's very sad because I see these children coming up, first grade, second grade, third grade, and they have that mentality. That's what's in our music. That's what's in our television. Hmm. That in everything is bad. And look at how they treat our president, our first black president. He's gotten more death threats than anything, and he's a black man. So there's a war. It's unspoken to some people because they're disingenuous and they may not even want to see it. But it's definitely going on.
But this has accentuated it. Keenan, thank you very much. Jelani Cobb, Keenan, I'm glad you called. We're times against me here, but talked about Jelani's the lack of leadership within the black community that we just heard from the caller.
Well, I mean, my problem with this is that I don't want to turn this into a conversation about the problem with black people. Because we wouldn't, you know, look at some other community and say if something this tragic happened that somehow or another we shift the blame on other citizens, and it betrays this kind of larger conversation in which we look at problems that are fundamentally American problems. But if these are American problems that particularly affect black people, we describe them as black problems and then put other citizens in charge of fixing them. So we never would say, if we were to look at poverty in Appalachia, we would never see some random white person and say, this is your problem, this is your responsibility, why have you not fixed it? However, we see black poverty, we'll turn around and say to black people, you all should fix this, which is implicitly stating that your citizenship here is not primarily how we think of you. We think of you as a distinct group that should be handling your own affairs. And so while that is an issue, certainly people talked about a kind of feeble grassroots leadership that has developed and flourished amazingly in the last few months.
Yep.
But people did talk about that, but I don't think that's the fundamental problem.
Jelani Cobb, we'll get to it after the break. We're discussing the protests in Ferguson after the grand jury's decision. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about reaction to the grand jury decision in Ferguson, Missouri, and you can join the conversation. Has the media done a good job telling the Ferguson story? Jelani Cobb is with us from Ferguson. He's a contributor to The New Yorker and professor at the University of Connecticut. Susan McGraw is also with us from St. Louis. She's a professor at the St. Louis University Law School and practicing defense attorney. Let me bring in now David Folkenflik. He's with us from New York. He's NPR's media correspondent. David, welcome back to On Point. Always nice to have you.
Thanks so much, Jane.
How has the media coverage impacted what's happened over the last 3 months in Ferguson since the shooting of Michael Brown, do you think?
Well, it's complicated. I think one of the most striking things about last night's announcement and performance by the district attorney in announcing that that the grand jury had not handed up indictments was the degree to which he indicted the media and social media. He clearly felt that the climate in which such decisions were announced had been in some ways poisoned by the relentless scrutiny, by the attention to emotion, and by the conveyance on social media. I don't think he was entirely fair. I think if you look back to the protests in August, which were not anything like as violent as what we have seen in the last 24 hours in Ferguson, that the national media's presence, helped. To be honest, the treatment of the national media and of reporters on the ground there in Ferguson by local law enforcement community gave, I think, real vibrance and life to the assertions by black residents of Ferguson that they had been sort of consistently run roughshod over and manhandled by law enforcement officials there. And the fact that that local police were essentially stiff-arming time and again, often for no reason, reporters on the scene in Ferguson meant that it was impossible to ignore the claim of locals. I'm not saying their claims shouldn't have been taken seriously anyway, but it was an interesting way in which they were a surrogate. Hmm. That said, over the last 24 hours, you've seen a lot of coverage where the coverage of the media is almost exclusively of what the media is experiencing on the ground, the degree to which they are being receiving tear gas from law enforcement officials who are trying to quell protests getting out of hand. And I think there's been – it's almost as though you have the camera turning in on itself in a way that I think is not useful, and you're seeing fragmentary, almost kaleidoscopic coverage and very little pullback and looking at the meat of what was found and what was alleged in the incident that led to all this tumult.
Here's the sound to which you initially referred, David. Robert McCullough, the St. Louis prosecuting attorney, critical of the media's coverage last night of the Ferguson shooting.
The most significant challenge encountered in this investigation has been the 24-hour news cycle and its insatiable appetite for something, for anything, to talk about, following closely behind with the nonstop rumors on social media. I recognize, of course, that the lack of accurate detail surrounding the shooting frustrates the media and the general public and helps breed suspicion among those already distrustful of the system.
David Folkenflik, you say fragmentary coverage, kaleidoscopic coverage. I'm reading a tweet here that went out last night from a columnist that said, quote, MSNBC and CNN about 5 seconds away from leading the looting. Speak a little bit more to that. An unfair characterization?
You certainly saw people kind of taking sides. There were these moments. I was talking with our colleague Eric Deggans, the TV critic for NPR, earlier this morning, and he and I were talking, and it seemed as though at times Van Jones, a former community activist, a briefly an Obama White House official turned CNN pundit, a guy who knows a lot about street protests, you know, he was saying, look, the people who are bad actors in the crowd are very low. You saw Chris Cuomo, somebody who almost takes a prosecutorial tone in reporting about crime and public unrest, you know, he, although a colleague of Van Jones, was essentially put in almost a crossfire-like oppositional position to what Van Jones was saying and suggesting that, no, the percentage of those who wanted to do damage and wanted to act out was actually far greater. And, you know, I don't think that's really serving a purpose. I don't think that the day of the announcement of an important decision not to indict someone in a closely watched case with questions of law enforcement, question of safety of law enforcement officers, question of racial relations and a host of other issues, you know, that's the moment to get into a crossfire-like atmosphere. Similarly, MSNBC was very much, you know, on the side of those who were protesting and objecting. And you saw over on Fox News, the emphasis was almost exclusively on the idea that that protesters were acting illegitimately and out of turn. And, you know, this is, you know, it's almost like different voices in a Greek chorus. And if you look at any one of them, you're seeing – you're hearing a voice in that chorus, but you're not seeing a bigger picture. You know, 24-hour news is this constant lens, and it doesn't allow for deep breaths and taking pauses. But they could have easily retreated to studio and talked about these things and unpacked them and figured out where they needed to go, but rather than just having, you know, oftentimes reporters vamp as – uncertain things happened behind them. I must say that, you know, Jake Tapper on CNN stood out by virtue of calmly and soberly interviewing some of the protesters about what they were experiencing. Chris Cuomo repeatedly kept saying to people who were, you know, chanting or shouting or trying to interject, he said, "Let us continue our coverage here." But it meant that he was never actually talking to anybody involved on any side about what was happening, you know, as things were breaking out around him.
David, hold on. Let's go back to the phones. Here's Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, welcome to On Point. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
That's Tahlequah, Oklahoma.
Tahlequah. Thank you, sir.
I'll try to be brief. I'll just say right off the bat, nobody has any right to shoot somebody because of their attitude. Okay? So let's set that straight. Whether you're a cop or just somebody on the street or whether you're at your house, nobody has a right to shoot somebody because of their attitude. Now, the problem of leadership is at the top, not the bottom, not in the black community. The problem of leadership is at the top. It's with the republic. And that's what we're getting here, this menacing, violent militarization of the police all over the country. And it's bad. It's been bad for a long time. There's been one event after the next. The lack of leadership is at the top.
Dave, Bob, thank you. I'm glad you called. As Seth is in Willoughby, New York. Let's go to him. Seth, welcome. Hello.
Hey, Jane. Thanks for taking my call here.
Sure.
I just have to point out that a lot of these people are not looking at the facts. You know, if you put your hands on a police officer, especially if you're reaching for his weapon, you have to understand there's some serious repercussions for that. And I'm not saying he was right by shooting him, but, you know, what if he just holstered his weapon and put six rounds in the cop? Would we be singing the same story? Would there be cops hiding in the street?
Seth,
that's all I have to say.
Seth, thank you. Susan McGraw, let me bring you back in here. I've been reading some of the transcript this morning. Here's a piece of it from another media outlet. It says, according to witnesses in blood and other evidence found inside the car, Officer Wilson first fired two shots while he struggled with Mr. Brown through the window of his patrol car, grazing Mr. Brown's hand. Brown started to run away with Officer Wilson in chase, then stopped and turned. According to the prosecutor's summary, the officer fired five shots as Mr. Brown charged him, then another five shots as he made what one witness called, quote, a full charge. I mean, is this a matter of just really getting down to the brass tacks here and figuring out what is truth based on all the evidence that that the grand jury saw?
Well, those were the facts that the prosecutor highlighted, but there were, you know, differing accounts. In the end, the grand jury can only do the best they can with what they have. And obviously, they made some decisions about facts that supported the fact that Officer Wilson acted in self-defense or was fearing for his life when he fired those shots. So it's difficult to go back and dispute it. But I think it's important to note that there were many accounts that differed as to what those five moments for Michael Brown were like.
Can I say something?
Sure, Jelani Kam, go ahead.
And so, you know, let's go back to this issue of the believability. So the last caller said that, you know, basically if you put your hands on an officer, something bad is going to happen. And let's just assume that that was the case. That does not mean that that officer should pursue someone firing at them as they're running away. And then fire at them, as people have said, with his hands up when he turned around. But even let's take it back to the basic point here about believing that Michael Brown attacked this officer. The only person who has a eyewitness perspective is Dorian Johnson, who was with Mr. Brown at the time, and he said that the officer, in fact, opened his door. The door bumped against Mr. Brown. This angered him. He then grabbed Mr. Brown around the neck, pulling him toward the car. That was the version of the story that we heard from the only other eyewitness. So in framing it the way that the caller did, he effectively said, this is the version of the story that most resonates with me, so I'm going to treat it as fact. But that is not the only version of how this incident transpired.
Alan is in Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Alan. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the point that, you know, regardless of whether this indictment went through or not, I don't think that it excuses the attitudes of the communities in Ferguson that are these people that are rioting and looting, you know, businesses in their own community. I turned on CNN this morning and see the liquor store that Michael Brown allegedly robbed cigars from being looted by, you know, people that I assume are from that community. And I just don't understand why our leadership in these towns and communities aren't stepping up and preventing people and stopping them from, you know, destroying the community that they live in and destroying the businesses that they patron.
Alan, thank you. Here's NCAA President Cornell Williams-Brooks to your point. Speaking on CBS this morning about the grand jury decision, he said that Michael Brown died a violent death and protesters should turn away from violence when honoring him.
We're calling on people in Ferguson, in Missouri, and across the country and joining us in a march from the home of Michael Brown in Ferguson to the home of the governor in Jefferson City. We're calling on people to push for a change in policing, a change in the way we police our communities. We're calling for legislative reform. We're calling for the kind of systemic, fundamental reform that can change this country and prevent future deaths.
Let's go back to Will in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Will. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah.
Hello. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please, Will. You're on the air.
Yes. As a black man and also as a military veteran, it's like if I did something like that, if I was a cop and I shot an 18-year-old white teenager, there is no doubt in my mind that they would indict me for killing this young man, even though if he did the same exact thing that Michael Brown did. Now, it was now that's where the double standard kicks in right there. If a white cop shoots a black unarmed teenager, hey, it's no big deal. It's just part of that job. But if a black cop shoots a white teenager, oh, my gosh, it would be a never-ending story, just like if some girl disappeared and they kept putting her face in the news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Got it, Will. I hear you're saying a double standard. Jelani Cobb, would you respond to that?
I mean, there is a double standard. I think it's just very clear. That's what people have been about here. And for the previous caller, one other thing about the logic of rioting. I think the riots happen because people feel that they've exhausted all other mechanisms for being heard. And for someone who has no reason to doubt that the legal system is capable of producing a just outcome for them, then the behavior does appear to be irrational. But the honest truth of the matter is that, you know, this country is rooted in riots. The American Revolution was born out of what began as a kind of disparate riots responding to British policy. This is not as if these people are completely out of their minds, as if they have no sense. What they believe is that the system here does not represent them. Prior to Michael Brown being killed, there was an incident of a Ferguson police officer, shoving a woman who had actually called the police because her car had been hit. She'd been shoved off her porch and kicked in the stomach by a police officer. There's another instance in which a 12-year-old boy was hogtied by a police officer. There was another instance of brutality in which four officers beat a motorist who was arrested and then charged him with destruction of public property for getting his blood on their uniforms. Mm-hmm. There is a context for this.
David Folkenflik, let me jump in here because I want you to respond to the media portrayal of the rioters during this whole situation, David.
Well, I was very struck by, for example, last night on Fox, there was a very large chyron at the base of the screen as I believe Shep Smith, one of their news anchors, but also as Sean Hannity, obviously one of their top opinion hosts, spoke. And it said, I want to get the phrasing exactly right, but it said something along the lines of, violence in multiple American cities or something like that. And it wasn't clear to me that there was violence in multiple American cities. You heard some anecdotal evidence of things happening in Oakland, perhaps, but you saw these major protests, or significant ones anyway, in New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Chicago, some other places, without actually any report of any consequential violence or that was a notable part of the protests occurring. And you know, it was something that people had talked about for days, particularly on Fox, but not solely on Fox, and tutting about and essentially saying, well, you know, it's important these protesters not do it. And there was a genuine public safety element to those concerns. And yet there was also in some ways almost a gleeful and provocative element to it as well, where if you harp on that and you I'm not saying it's inciting violence. I'm just saying that there's almost a desire for there to be some backlash against the protesters and an ability to depict protesters as somehow doing that. Now, what we saw last night was genuinely violent. What we saw were actual fires that had been set. And you saw a police cruiser was on fire at one point and other things. But you were seeing such a tight focus on things that it was hard to understand what the greater story was. And when Fox is showing those images and saying that there was violence in multiple cities, it made it sound somehow as though what had happened after, say, you know, the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King. And that was not what occurred in the country last night.
Susan McGraw, in our last minute here, I'm just curious, with this decision, is the Department of Justice likely to bring federal charges now? And what about a civil lawsuit filed by the Michael Brown family?
Well, there's absolutely no bar to a civil lawsuit. This has no effect on their ability to bring a lawsuit. My understanding is that they have hired counsel in order to pursue that lawsuit. You know, I would be guessing on whether or not the federal government will bring charges. The feeling around here is that there will not be.
Well, thank you very much. A top-notch panel and some really interesting perspective today. Susan McGraw, professor of law at St. Louis University Law School. Thank you, Susan, very much.
Thank you.
Jelani Cobb, contributor to The New Yorker, director of Africana Studies and professor of history at the University of Connecticut. Thank you for being with us, Jelani. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. Thanks as always, David.
You bet.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.